DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
Hello and welcome to Living Planet. I'm Charlotte Lomas in Bonn, Germany. Coming up on the show, the latest from Brussels on a possible ban on glyphosate. Also on the program, saving food from the bin to feed the homeless. Plus, economic turmoil forces Greeks to rethink how they feed themselves, with delicious results. All that and more coming up. In April, the European Union again delayed a decision on whether to reauthorise glyphosate, a controversial yet widely used agricultural chemical. Another attempt to reach a decision will be made on Monday, the 6th of June. The licence for glyphosate is due to run out this month, and if no decision is taken by the end of June, glyphosate could be banned in Europe. Ahead of the planned meeting, I spoke with DW reporter Dave Keating in Brussels. So, Dave, why has the EU been having such a hard time coming to an agreement on this?
Well, the decision actually needs to be taken by the 28 national governments of the EU, and they are very split. There's a large blocking minority led by France. France believes that the substance is too dangerous to reauthorize. Other countries like the UK and Spain want to maintain the authorization. Germany has been on the fence because of a split within its governing coalition. So that has meant there's been no majority for or against the reauthorization of glyphosate.
And why is France so concerned about glyphosate?
Well, the uproar really exploded last year after the World Health Organization released a study identifying a hazard with glyphosate as a quote-unquote probable carcinogen, which means it could cause cancer. This appeared to contradict the findings of the EU's Food Safety Authority, which had found that it's safe. Now, the timing was really bad for the companies that use this substance because it came right as the 15-year authorization period for glyphosate was coming to an end. Environmentalists, who are ideologically opposed to these high-strength pesticides in general, have been exerting enormous pressure on politicians to end the authorization. In April, the European Parliament adopted a resolution calling for glyphosate authorization to be renewed, but with severe restrictions and for a shorter 7-year period. And just to dramatize the issue, some members of the parliament even conducted urine tests to show how much glyphosate they have in their system. All of the 48 MEPs who took the test came up positive for having glyphosate in their system, some at very high levels.
And well, why would the EU reauthorize a substance that could cause cancer?
Well, it's not quite that simple. The WHO study was only looking at the hazard of the substance itself, but not at the risk posed by normal usage. So the pesticide industry has countered that the study has no real meaning because all kinds of things are hazardous in large doses, but not in the amount that we ordinarily use them. Now, since that WHO study, a UN study came out last month concluding that glyphosate is safe under normal usage. But green groups have cast doubt on that study, claiming that the chairman of the UN Institute that conducted it also heads an organization that has in the past received a six-figure donation from the American agrochemical company Monsanto. Now, Monsanto is the main company using glyphosate, which it uses in a product called Roundup.
So what's Monsanto's role in all of this?
I would say Monsanto's association with the issue has attracted a more emotive response from the public. This is a company that has been controversial with the public in Europe because, in addition to making pesticides, it also makes genetically modified crops, which are very controversial in Europe.
And all of this comes as a new merger bid means Monsanto may become European, right?
Yes. The German agrochemical company Bayer has made a $62 billion bid for Monsanto. That's going to attract the attention of competition regulators because it would create a really dominant player in the agrochemical field. But one thing it would allow Monsanto to do is rebrand. For whatever reason, Bayer does not seem to attract the same ire as Monsanto, even though they are involved in roughly the same activities. Perhaps this is because Bayer is a European company and Monsanto is American, or because Monsanto is more specialized in GMO and seeds. But I think the glyphosate controversy shows how problematic the Monsanto name has become.
And so what's next for the glyphosate decision?
Well, the European Commission announced on Wednesday that it's going to convene another meeting of EU member states for next Monday, the 6th of June. This time, it will put forward a new proposal for a vote that would instead call for a quote-unquote technical extension that would last just 12 to 18 months, rather than the 15 years originally under consideration, and even shorter than the 7 years called for by the Parliament. Now, this is a significant climb down by the Commission. They say that during the temporary extension, more studies will be carried out. At the same time, they're pointing out that the Food Safety Authority's studies are pretty rock solid, so they seem kind of annoyed that they have to do this. But this temporary extension has a much better chance of being approved by member states. And actually, this represents a big victory for the environmental campaigners who have been railing against glyphosate. Still, there is a chance that even this temporary extension won't be acceptable for some of the reluctant governments. If there's still no majority for or against, the Commission could theoretically reauthorize the substance on its own. But it is ordinarily very reluctant to do this on politically sensitive issues like this one. Now, if there's no agreement on Monday, the Commission will be under significant pressure to do something. Farmers say that there is no alternative available for glyphosate in the short term, and a sudden ban could be a disaster for the harvest. But if the European Commission were to unilaterally reauthorize without the member states' blessing, it would cause fury among environmentalists and probably wouldn't go down very well with the public at large. From what I'm hearing, I expect the national governments to approve this temporary extension on Monday. And so we'll be back talking about this again in a year's time.
That was Dave Keating there talking about the EU's upcoming decision on glyphosate. And to find out what comes out of the meeting on Monday, June 6th, head to dw.com/environment or follow us on Twitter at dw_eco. Well, if food production raises some big environmental concerns, so too does where it ends up. Every year, some 1.3 billion tonnes, or about a third, of all the food we produce gets thrown out. It's a shocking figure, considering nearly 800 million people globally don't have enough to eat. But in Chile, a growing number of initiatives are showing that it's possible to provide those in need with delicious, nutritious meals from the food that was headed for the trash. Our reporter Jane Chambers found out more and filed this report from Santiago.
Chile is famous for its delicious fruit and vegetables, which are exported all over the world. The next time you go to a supermarket, you'll probably find some Chilean grapes, blueberries, or tomatoes. Many locals come to markets like this one in Santiago to buy their produce. The problem is that when you walk past this market at the end of the day, you'll see piles and piles of produce thrown away and going to waste, which is why one group, called Oye Ravani, decided to do something about it. At the foothills of the Andes on the outskirts of Santiago, 42-year-old Amina Ivanes is in the kitchen cooking up a storm. So what have we got in the pan? You can hear it sizzling away.
We love garlic, so a lot of garlic, onions and peppers.
Smells delicious. And that is the base of what?
Of the tomato soup. Tomato soup.
The soup Amina is preparing is made using ingredients that would otherwise have been destined for the bin, and you can tell. In front of me, we've got a green bowl full of very red tomatoes. If you look a bit closer, some of them look like ones that you might not find in a supermarket because they're not completely perfect. And we've got courgettes, which are a little bit wrinkly, and some red peppers. But things that look to me like they're perfectly edible. It's true, you're laughing, you're moving the courgette about and it does look a bit wobbly. It looks like one of the ones that's been around for a while. Where have these come from and what are you doing with them?
The main thing comes from a free market in Ñuñoa that we have a very nice relationship like for 4 years, that every week we go to get all the things that they are going to throw, that they can't sell. So they give it to us, and then we recover and we get the best of it for the food. The things that we can't cook, we give to the chickens, or there are two very nice goats. Or at the end, we give it to the worms, because we have also worms and a rabbit.
As Amina mentioned, every week she and other volunteers collect or are given unwanted and often ugly fruit and vegetables from their local market. They transform the produce into edible meals to feed the homeless.
I think for us, the main thing is to give food to people that are hungry. I mean, if you come to Santiago de Chile, there are people with a lot of money and people that really have a very precarious life. So we try to cross the two lines, you know, because, I mean, I can't eat in my house with my family a nice dinner thinking that there are people that are very hungry.
Eduardo is one of the helpers at La Olla Ravani. Every Saturday, they go to the largest fruit and vegetable market in the center of Santiago, a place called La Vega. Here, they put huge vats of food on a table and ladle out lunch to the long queue of homeless people waiting for them.
We are serving up food to all the people standing here in line. Today, we have a salad, tomato soup, and a lentil and vegetable stew. Many of the volunteers here are Sufi Muslims, so for us, it's a form of spiritual and physical help. We give our food to people who really need it. These are homeless people who have no work, and life is hard for them.
When the project began 4 years ago, the group had just one saucepan. After word quickly spread, more and more people started coming. Today, La Olla Ravani initiate feeds around 200 people a week.
I live on the streets here in Santiago. This is a great project, and it really helps people like me. And the food is delicious.
My name is Carlos, and I also live on the streets. I heard about this through a friend, and it has helped me so much. It's the best food I get all week.
Back in the kitchen, volunteer Javiera Paris assists Amina with the cooking. As she stirs another batch of tomato soup, she tells me food waste in Chile just isn't a priority for people.
It's not a subject, you know, we're in Latin America. So here there are issues that are like big issues, like, you know, poverty, health, education, and this is like, nah, you don't bother me, you know, this is going to waste and that's it.
Because this is not seen as a very important topic in Chile, there aren't many studies about just how much food has been wasted. But a recent survey showed that 95% of people asked admit to throwing food away. Mainly it's vegetables and bread that they bought too much of and have forgotten about in the fridge. Javiera Paris was so inspired by the efforts of La Olla Ravani that she set up another initiative called Recupera Lab, which aims to get people in Chile thinking about their own personal food waste.
The first big step, and for us it would be like a big issue, people to start talking about this and realizing they actually are we are all throwing away food, you know. And after that, stop throwing away and making some recovery, because you try to realize that there's people involved, there are resources involved, and we're throwing away the planet and work, and we're so disconnected right now that we treat tomatoes and anything like plastic.
And that, Javiera says, requires a cultural shift.
We don't eat together anymore. We're on the cell phones. We don't talk with our grandparents. So it's about, like, recovering cultural traditions or social traditions, you know? Like, my grandmother used to use everything, and we don't know nothing about it. So it's like start talking again, eating together, talking about food, and it links people again. You know, like, food for us is an excuse to make people realize we have to link again with our planet and heaven and people and everywhere, you know. If we don't make that connection, that's why we're throwing everything away.
La Olla Ravani and Recupera Lab are part of a growing number of projects that are taking off in Chile. It might be early days, but this long, skinny country at the bottom of the world is starting to take food waste seriously. Jane Chambers, DW, Santiago.
Chile isn't the only place reconnecting with traditional attitudes to food in a bid to solving today's problems. Greeks have become used to trying to survive amidst economic turmoil. The public sector is still shrinking and more than a fifth of the population is unemployed. So a new generation of Greeks is getting back to basics, seeking out innovative culinary solutions to help them get through the bad times. And as Heidi Fuller Love reports, they've been rediscovering their culinary heritage along the way.
Here at the Greek Gastronomy Museum near Athens' very hip Psyri district, and just a stroll away from the colourful Varvakio Central Food Market, Konstantinos Matsodelis, one of the museum's 20-something founders, presents the latest exhibition, The Reflection of the Plate.
In Greece, there's a trend with local products. We have more and more of them. People who had office jobs, they had to quit during the crisis and return to their homeland and produce new agricultural products. And more of them, they do also the packaging, and that's one of the good things that the crisis brought to us, the need to produce more on our own.
Working with local artists, he also wanted to support new food businesses set up by fellow graduates who couldn't find work. With his sister, an Athens art curator, he came up with the idea of linking food and art.
We asked 12 artists to work on the topic of Greek cuisine and modern society and how has this influenced one another. So each of the artists presents an exhibit as well as a recipe. We have so many things that we don't know about our culinary culture. There was a period of 20 years that imported products were thought to be better. Nowadays, consumers, they choose again to buy local products. We are very optimistic about the future.
Step outside the halls of the museum, and food is a preoccupation at all levels of society. It has been estimated that 4 in 10 people have difficulty feeding themselves, and countless children are sent to school on empty stomachs.
I've been very blessed in my life, very lucky, and I didn't need to do much to have a fantastic life. So I felt that I need to do something to help these people.
Alexandros Theodoridis is one of the founders of Borome. The name means we can. It's a groundbreaking organization. Based in Athens, it was created to funnel leftover food from different shops, supermarkets and other businesses to people in need via organizations on the ground. Set up in 2012, the organization now donates food provided by organizations ranging from local bakeries to huge multinational chains like IKEA, to some 400 welfare organizations. These include old people's homes, soup kitchens, and even orphanages.
We function as a virtual food bank, and what we do is, because we didn't have any money to have a warehouse and vehicles to move around, like the classical model of a food bank, we needed to be inventive, and that was fantastic because we thought, okay, we can just skip logistics, which is 90% of the food-saving equation, and we connect directly those who have food with those who need it. So that makes it extremely easy for somebody to give, because he doesn't have anything else to do than call us up. Plus, we can save everything. We save from a bakery, we save food from a private party, we save from weddings, up to Chiquita or the largest food companies in Greece, or IKEA, the stores.
Invention among Greece's generations of graduates is rife. With a lack of jobs in the capital, Athens, however, some have moved back to some of the more remote Greek villages, where they're not only breathing new life into the aging social scene, they are also rehabilitating traditional cooking methods and life skills that would otherwise have been lost. On a busy street corner of Arkan, a Cretan village with some 4,500 inhabitants, Ploumi, named for the endemic purple flower that grows on Cretan slopes, is a cooperative which offers a social restaurant, grocery and cultural activities, including free music classes for children.
Our activities are related to cultural activities, nutrition and Cretan cuisine, and all professions that have been lost. Our activities are related to people who want to share or learn their talents. And we try to convince more and more people to participate.
One of those office workers mentioned by Konstantinos at the Gastronomy Museum, computer engineer Christoforos Augustiniatos, seized the chance to change direction when work dried up in his hometown Patras in the northern Peloponnese. Arriving in Arkan a few years ago, he helped set up this Cretan cooperative, which currently fosters local initiatives ranging from market gardening to food foraging.
The whole project is not about money. The whole meaning is to give back to people social benefits. When life becomes difficult, I believe that we are alone against the problems. But we believe that with teamwork and with cooperatives and with taking our life in our hands and help each other, we'll solve many of the problems.
Greek physician Hippocrates said, "Let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food." Born out of the current economic crisis, a new generation of Greeks are hoping that these innovative food projects and others like them will be the long-awaited medicine that will kickstart their country's ailing economy, keeping Greek stomachs full in the process. Heidi Fullerlove, DW Crete.
As Greeks rediscover their culinary traditions, in the US region of New England, another tradition is at stake. Lobsters there are struggling. Disease and warmer waters are threatening their existence, as well as the livelihoods of the lobstermen who, for generations, have made a living hauling lobster pots out of Long Island Sound and the Atlantic Ocean. At the Stonington Dock in southeastern Connecticut, Eilish O'Neill caught up with lobster man Mike Grimshaw to find out more.
I'm looking for Mike Grimshaw.
Oh. What did I ever do to you? No, Mike's out. No, he's not out.
He's not out.
He told me to meet him by his boat around 1.
Well, you got a choice. You can meet him over there or you can meet him there.
Probably be right here.
Mike Grimshaw's tall and robust with a salt and pepper beard, sunglasses, and a camouflage baseball cap. We meet by one of his boats, the one with an American flag and a mermaid tied to the mast, and we perch on a couple of lobster holding cases while we talk.
He's laying on the floor. I told you I'm always with a white dog.
Sit if you wish.
Mike Grimshaw is the president of the Southern New England Lobstermen's Association. He's been lobstering for decades.
Love it. There's no other way to put it. I just love it. The independence, the water, the vastness of it, you know, the beauty, the thrill. I mean, like people go to the casino and they pull that lever, you know, they think, oh my God, this is it, you know. Me, when I turn that lever for the traps to come up, I feel that same rush probably. You know, that's why I quit and said, why do you? I said, I go to the casino every day when I push that lever and all them traps up. You never know what you're going to get until it's on the rail.
But these days, that livelihood is disappearing.
Best week in life, I was around it. I was just shy of 14,000 pounds for a week. But I'll never see a day like that. I can't imagine.
1998-99 was the peak in the lobster population in southern New England, including Long Island Sound, tremendous abundance, and then suddenly a stock collapse occurred. We had a die-off in 98, 99, and then ever since then, the stock has continued to decline.
Dave Simpson's a biologist at the Connecticut Department of Environmental Protection. He says over 90% of Long Island Sound's lobster population has disappeared, and with it, over 90% of what was once a multi-million dollar industry. As the lobsters are dying off, the lobstermen are struggling to hold on.
It's a way of life for so many people. It's the rhythm and nature of being on the water, being around the docks, coming in the afternoon, your catch, sharing that with fellow fishermen. That's a big thing, you know, to somebody's lifestyle, and I think it's been really tough for a lot of those folks to lose that.
Exactly why the lobsters are dying is a contentious issue in Connecticut and New York State. Many of the lobstermen blame pesticides. That's because in the late 1990s, there was an outbreak of the West Nile virus in New York State, and public health officials sprayed pesticides everywhere.
And mosquitoes are just like lobsters. They're from the same phylum, arthropods. So when this stuff was dispensed, we had a huge storm. It was called Hurricane Floyd, in which all these chemicals was then washed it all into Long Island Sound.
Nick Crismolli was a lobsterman in western Connecticut for decades.
We saw the reaction to the animals. The animals were prematurely molting.
5 years ago, Crismolli decided he couldn't make it as a lobsterman anymore. He sold his boat and permits, and he started a restaurant, the Lobster Shack. Scientists at the Department of Environmental Protection and the New York Sea Grant didn't find evidence that it was pesticides that killed the lobsters.
The general consensus and conclusion was that given at the time and looking at the circulation models and the amount of pesticides that were being applied, that was not believed to be a very likely cause of the system-wide die-off.
Antoinette Clementson's a fishery specialist at the New York Sea Grant. She says a whole host of other issues came together to kill off lobsters. Chemicals from plastics interfere with lobsters' hormonal systems, paramoebas attack them, and climate change has led to warming waters.
For the last 15 years, we've had above average water temperatures, and that's largely the driver behind the collapse in the stock, the failed production of young, increase in disease and mortality. The threshold for lobster temperature is about 20 degrees C or 68 or so degrees Fahrenheit, and above that is extremely stressful to lobsters.
The number of days per year that the water of Long Island Sound has reached 20 degrees Celsius or warmer has doubled over the past two decades. Back on the dock, Mike Grimshaw and the other lobstermen are done for the day. They're winding up meters and meters of rope. Grimshaw says he's looked for other work, but it's hard to switch careers.
Up until now, I've been able to sustain myself just by doing this only, but it's come to the point where I might have to think about doing something, because I tried putting applications out last year and the year before to do almost anything with very poor results. It's not that I'm uneducated or unskilled, I am, but I guess nobody wants to hire a 60-year-old guy.
So every day, Grimshaw's back on the dock, working alongside his son Ryan to see if he can pull a living out of his lobster pots.
The illusion of saying I'm a full-time lobsterman is gone. It's been gone for a couple years. I'm just stubborn and dragging my feet. I'm probably, you know, like the dinosaur or the buffalo hunter, one of the last of the dying breed.
Well, that wraps up today's show. If you'd like to listen to past episodes, just download the Living Planet podcast on iTunes or simply visit our website at dw.com/environment. I'm Charlotta Lomas. Catch you next week.
you.